You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 1st to the 7th of August 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, writers Matthew Rice and David Matthews, and news editor Simon Baker. Today's issue review will see us take a whistle-stop tour through some of the week's highlights in our book section. Matthew will be telling us a bit more about his feature on how female academics at different stages of their careers have juggled the demands of family and work life. One academic's defence of Madeleine Atkins, the new Hefke chief executive, will also be discussed. That follows some criticisms about her suitability for the role. But first, as ever, we will start with our lead news story. David, you, I know from sitting opposite you, have spent quite a bit of the last week crunching some figures and re-crunching some figures to highlight the variation in student workloads between universities. What's this all about?
Yes, I'm totally sick of Excel by now. So you might remember in May, there was a report that came out by the consumer organisation Which and the Higher Education Policy Institute that looked at student workloads across subjects and universities. And they found pretty big discrepancies between subjects and universities in terms of how many scheduled and private hours students are working. What we've done is taken the detailed data from that. So they didn't really release it by university, but we've got that data and looked at it. And what we've sort of found is that there's very, very broadly, there's a sort of a correlation between the kind of selectivity of university mission groups and the amount of work that students do each week. So, for example, the Russell Group universities, they're slightly more likely than the 1994 group or Million Plus group. Their universities are slightly more likely to have an above average workload for each subject. And it's quite interesting because not only is there that, but there's quite a big kind of a jumbling up of the universities. So in some tables you'll see, well, I didn't quite expect that Russell Group University to be at the bottom of the table. Perhaps I didn't expect that university to be quite so high up. But there was a massive variation, basically.
Are there any particularly sort of guilty parties, any courses, any universities out there where students can show up for a sort of surprisingly, maybe a worryingly low number of hours?
At the bottom of the pile is business administration studies students at Leeds Metropolitan University who work a total of just under 16 hours a week.
And what's this? Is this contact time or does this include private study?
No, it includes both of those. So it's about 10 hours a week of scheduled study and then 6 hours private study. Now, you can judge whether you think that's high enough to earn you a degree at the end, but at the very top of that subject list is Manchester, and they do almost 40 hours a week, so they're working well over twice as, almost three times as much as people at Leeds Met. And of course this kind of brings up yet again the kind of thorny, intractable issue of the comparability of degree standards. So what HEPI say is, okay, so you've got some students working far less than others. Now, if they get the same degree at the end, and generally most of them do get two ones or firsts, now one explanation for that might be is they were just kind of brighter, better prepared at the beginning, and then you don't need to work as long as that. Whereas in fact what this kind of again shows is actually the reverse. So the more qualified students that come in, they do more work at university. So if you're doing more work and you're better qualified to begin with, and you still, everyone sort of gets a degree at the end. Have they the same standard of degree? So it raises that question once again.
Are these independent study hours self-reported?
They are.
So it could well be that there's a great variation in the reality, and it has to do with the reasons that people would want to claim they're working more hours.
Well, quite, yes. I mean, I suppose that's the problem with any sort of self-reported study. But I suppose that unless, students at University of Oxford and Cambridge are, vastly more neurotic, I suppose, and desperate to report enormously high study hours and sort of fiddling the figures, then it should apply across all universities. And, Which say that they have a cut-off point for the number of students who have to reply, and they're confident in the results. Although, you're right, some universities did query, the validity of this kind of analysis.
I mean, I was just going to say that the other thing with Oxford and Cambridge is they have shorter terms, don't they? So if you're just asking how many hours they work in a in a week, then they're just going to talk about their typical week. But Oxford and Cambridge do work, they do have shorter terms, but they're much more intensive, aren't they? I mean, I think that doesn't really explain why they're at the top at all, but you'd still expect them to be very high up, but it is worth bearing in mind, I suppose.
Yeah. And some, the University Alliance, the mission group, who some of the universities have slightly lower working hours, point out that they, you know, have sandwich years and work placements that they say they excel at. But then I suppose I don't know whether there's any evidence on who does more of that kind of work outside of term time.
And presumably the contact hours are not self-reported; those are provided by the university.
I think it's all self-reported. I think it's all self-reported.
Yeah. Well, an interesting read. Lots of tables to go along with that as well to keep you busy when you have a minute. But from news to features, the cover feature this week looks at the reasons why so many HE institution leaders end up losing their job. Apparently it's 50 every year in the US, which is where this feature originated. It's penned by Stephen Joel Tachenberg, former president of George Washington University. But there are plenty of lessons in there for those in the UK higher education sector as well, or any other country sector for that matter. Do take a look. But Matthew, you authored the second feature in this week's magazine, which looks at female academics and the tough task of juggling the demands of family and academic life. This comes from a book, doesn't it? Take me through this.
It's an American, a North American book, and by a collection of testimonies, essentially, from academics who are also mothers, either at graduate school or later in their careers. And it's the dealing with looking at all the problems and issues which arise. And there are some very considerable problems, lots of stories about, horrible stories about patronising professors, you know, people coming back from maternity leave and being told that they've been on a sabbatical, which is unfair to all the other assistant professors. The woman that had just had twins and had hardly had time to, you know, eat or shower while she was away. The United States, of course, maternity leave is extremely limited anyway, and there's a very, very strict schedule whereby people get tenure or fail to get tenure. And so if you take time off to have a child, you're still on the tenure clock, and this can affect careers for the rest of your life. So there are some good stories of where relatively generous maternity leave and people who, there's cases where the tenure clock has been stopped for 1 year. So there are positive developments, but I think, even compared to Britain and certainly compared to somewhere like Scandinavia, they're operating within a system which is incredibly difficult. And, the challenges are immense, and most of the, even the women who end up saying that they have just about managed to have it all, it's all almost always at the expense of any sleep.
No, it's interesting. I suppose, it'd be interesting to look at the picture in some other countries as well, and among male academics too, I imagine, also have difficulties juggling the family life as it goes on. Is there anything, this is exclusively a female study?
This is a book of testimonies by about 20 women, specifically about 20 women. I mean, one of the things is that because there are very few rights in terms of maternity leave, there are people who are allowed leave, or in theory allowed leave, but they're sort of still, they're still expected to deliver one or two courses, you know, from their living room, or, you know, a few days after they've had a caesarean, sometimes, you know, against medical advice. And this is unpaid leave, so they're still working despite being unpaid and against medical advice. So there are optimistic stories in the book, but it's a pretty horrifying and depressing picture, really.
No, do have a read of that. We'll leave that there for now, though, and go back perhaps to the news section. Simon, perhaps you could fill us in on a story that we broke in the issue before this current one about Madeleine Atkins being unveiled as the chief executive of Hefke. I know there was some last-minute scrambling to get that in the edition last week, but this week we have one academic's defence of the appointment, really. It seems to follow some reported criticisms about it. Could you just let us know a bit more about that?
Well, yeah, I'd say one academic, I'd say it was kind of more than more than one. It was, well, there's more than one person anyway. I mean, certainly there's one academic who kind of features prominently as defending the appointment. But it's quite striking how many people have come out and kind of said publicly defended the appointment, really.
Sure.
Because I mean, really, what there hasn't been a specific sort of on the record criticism of the appointment, and this is what's kind of a little bit sort of snide about it, really, is there's been kind of the feeling off the record chit chatter in private, I think, that, well, Madeleine Atkins hasn't got a background of handling a large research budget because she's been the head of a post 92 university, basically, and therefore she possibly shouldn't be running the Higher Education Funding Council for England, where most of the money they have left is research funding for research-intensive universities. That's basically the inclination. Well, a lot of people have just come out and said, well, that's just plain daft. There's no evidence for that at all. Effectively, they've just sort of said, well, so they've looked at the university she's been at previously, a modern university, and therefore she can't run the Higher Education Funding Council for England, even though she's been on the board for quite a long time, has a lot of experience of HEFCE, has a lot of experience of the sector. And I think it's basically been painted as old-fashioned old university versus new university snobbery, really, I think.
But amazingly persistent for all that it's old-fashioned. It sounds like a one of us, not one of us.
Yeah, and it's amazing how this kind of thing does kind of crop up so often, really. I mean, and it's quite telling that nobody's actually come out and said that. I mean, prepared to say it on the record. Yeah, right. I mean, it does. There's various people. I mean, obviously, I suppose the people that have defended it are some of the come from the part of the sector that you'd expect. So Steve West, Vice Chancellor of University of West of England and Chair of University Alliance, represents a lot of post 92 universities. Has been was quite strident in his criticism of that point of view. Pam Tatlow from Million Plus, but Alex Bowles as well, Chief Executive of the 94 Group, research intensive group, also endorsed her appointment. So, you know, I think it's fair to say this is kind of sadly kind of typical and predictable of what some of the criticism that might have come out from this appointment, really.
It seems a bit strange as well. I mean, some of the sort of, as you say, off-record criticisms is that because Coventry doesn't have, you know, as a bigger research budget as some other universities, you wouldn't have experience of the QR, quality-related research funding system. But I would have thought at the moment, you know, a large chunk of your job as head of HEFCE is kind of working how you're going to deal with various new government policies. It's not really any... It's in fact, almost research allocation takes a bit of a back seat at the moment.
Well, it's formularic. I mean, there's already a formula for a blind QR funding, and it depends on the REF and the REE. But it's not as if you really need to have intricate knowledge of how that works to be able to run HEFCE. Yeah, it's bizarre, really.
Does this stuff not just make you, as news reporters, think that the old boys' club, the old school tie, the he's one of us, make sure we get ours culture, has not disappeared? It's 2013 and it's still a bunch of old buffers making sure that Oxford and Cambridge and the Russell Group get theirs.
I have to be obviously very neutral on kind of some of these points, I guess. But I am surprised, really, at sort of how much this kind of story does crop up, really. And you know, it does smack of kind of old fashioned attitudes, really, and it's quite surprising.
And it was very noticeable. Comments under articles often on completely unrelated topics. The comments would be about our post 92s real universities and so on, and it is a bit depressing. And as I say, the ingenuity to which, you know, an article about football that this could be or something would, you know, people would still bring up this one point.
Yeah, we've tried to crack down on that in our new website setup, making people register before they comment, which has helped to an extent. Well, on the old site, it certainly was.
But we can assume that there's still people.
It seems a very curious obsession. If you're pleased with your university background and an unimpeachable Russell Group, why do you need to spend time saying, "Goodness me, Coventry, that won't do"?
No, it's but it does, as you say, appear to be a persistent attitude. Karen, while we're talking, maybe it's an apt moment to hear a little bit about this week's book section.
Absolutely. I'm very pleased to say that this week's Book of the Week was written by Graham Farmelow, a physicist, a bifellow at Churchill College, and he was also the author of The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac. He won the Costa Biography Prize for that. So he's got a bit of form thinking about famous physicists. And here he looks at a book called Love, Literature and the Quantum Atom, Niels Bohr's 1913 trilogy revisited. So it's the centenary of Niels Bohr's key papers on quantum physics, the famous Danish physicist. The interesting angle on this story is that if you take the old saying, behind every successful man is a surprised woman, if you like to play it for jokes, the argument, I suppose, when you're looking at famous male scientists is behind every groundbreaking scientist, there's a woman who's been written out of the story. Now, this book is written by two male scholars, one who is the head of the Niels Bohr Archive in Copenhagen, and the other an American scientist who is now here in the UK. And they've looked at the relationship between Niels Bohr and his wife, Margrethe Norland. And they make the argument, actually, that not only were they terribly happy as a couple, and that was all very nice, but actually their intellectual relationship, their very creative discussions, helped to bring Bohr toward the discoveries he made. Now, Margrethe Norland was not a physicist, so that's even more surprising. If she had been a physicist, you could see that the argument would be made. They might have been crunching numbers at home. But the idea was that Bohr, who was also known as a very upstanding citizen, greatly admired, was getting a lot of his inspiration from his partner. Both of the authors said to me that this is probably not unusual. It's just that it's something biographers haven't looked at in the past, even to the extent that when looking at politicians or authors or other figures that they might have done so. So perhaps we can hope that when other lives of groundbreaking scientists are written, they'll look at the people around them, and maybe not just the surprised woman, but the influential woman as well. And also in this week's book section, I'm very pleased to say that we have Sir Howard Davies in our pages again. Many of you will remember him from his role leading the London School of Economics. He did a few things in the city as well. He's now at Sciences Po in Paris. And he's reviewed a book by a French academic, François Morin, who asks, should there be a world without Wall Street? Those of you who thought that perhaps Howard Davies would disagree with that would be right. The interesting thing is that Morin was a member of the Bank of France's General Council, as well as being a professor at the University of Toulouse. So not a wild-eyed radical in any case. But as Davies points out, the spread of political opinion in France is a lot wider than it is here. So it's not remotely surprising that perhaps someone who has held a top financial position might be making arguments that would cause people here to be rather shocked. And indeed, Sir Howard doesn't really hold with François Morin's ideas.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. Regular listeners will know that we do have a series of dedicated books podcasts on the site as well. There's five of those in the series now, all available on our website. So if you haven't listened, make sure you do. But until next week, that's the end of the Times Higher Issue Review. I'll also remind you, we are running our THE Best University Workplace Survey at present. If you work in a UK institution, please take 5 minutes out to fill that in. We want to find out what you love and loathe about the places where you are employed. We also have, as I always point out, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and Google Plus presence. So make sure you're following us on there if you want to continue the conversation. But until next week, that's the end of the Times Higher Education Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.